The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
My next guest's journey will be familiar to some. You might have heard the news back in the early months of 2023 of an Irishman falsely imprisoned in Iran. He spent months in what was dubbed Satan's Block in Mashhad prison alongside political prisoners, drug traffickers, paedophiles, other hostages, and some who were even awaiting execution. After a campaign by his family and the Irish government, well, it saw his release in May of 2023, and then he began rebuilding his life after 7 months spent in one of the harshest environments in the world. And he's now written his story down in a new book entitled You Will Die in Prison, subtitle My Time as a State Hostage in Iran. I'm delighted to say that Bernard Phelan is with me in studio. Bernard, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Pat.
I remember the ongoing conversations on radio with your relatives and the pleas for your release. And, you know, without knowing too much about it at the time, I was wondering, what was he up to? Why was he picked up? So what were you up to?
This was my fifth trip back to Iran. I was working with an Iranian tour operator helping to develop, to sell Iran to the public.
That's your business,
tourism. That was my business. I used to work with the Irish Tourist Board when I came to France in 86. My job then was to sell Ireland to the French. So here I was back selling Iran to the world. And I had been there, as I said, five times. And this time I was there working on a project to do the Silk Road by train. And we travelled around the north of Iran. I arrived on the 17th of September, just shortly after the start of the protests. I got caught up in it. And
now, why were you targeted? What were you doing? Were you taking pictures of something?
I had taken pictures of my phone, but that evening, which today, the 3rd of October, is the second anniversary of when I was arrested. This day, 2 years ago, I was arrested at 5 o'clock in the evening. My Iranian pal was taking photographs of the mosque with a big Canon camera. Two guys walked up to us, flashed the card and said, follow us. And we sat in a wall with them and they asked us for our passport. I gave them my Irish passport, my French passport. Then they came back and asked for our phones, went off with that and they came
back. Now, your visa was on the French passport?
Visa was on the French passport for practical reasons. And every time somebody would ask me what nationality were you, I would say I was Irish. But the Iranians have this diplomatic hostage system. They basically have a shopping list and they wanted more French hostages. I learned when I came back to Dublin, when I was released, when I met the Tornished and the people in the Department of Foreign Affairs, if the visa had been on the Irish passport, I would not have been arrested.
You would not have been picked up. So they take your possessions and, I mean, they're being courteous all the time?
Very courteous, very correct. The solitary confinement and the interrogation was pretty difficult. I mean, you're blindfolded, handcuffs, you sleep on the floor with a blanket.
This is in the initial interrogation you get taken to the block.
Exactly. And I'd be taken two or three times a day to meet an interrogator who would ask me questions, get me to sign documents. He'd have my phone, so he had all the information.
And the documents would be in Farsi?
The initial documents I would write, he'd say, write down your explanation. So I'd write it in French or in English and then put my fingerprint on it to say, this is what I said.
Okay, so that was just the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were going back through my whole history, all old photographs, you know, where was this picture taken? Who are these people?
All taken from your phone?
Yeah.
So when did it become obvious that you were not getting out quickly?
Very quickly, right from the first night when I was kept in the first interrogation centre and in the cell next door. In the middle of the night, I heard a door opening and somebody coming into that cell and beating somebody with a truncheon or a stick or something, and the guy screaming. And I knew then I was in trouble. Mm. This was not going to get me over soon. Yeah.
Then you went to this prison. You were taken away. You were told to close your eyes. You kept them squinty open to see where you were going. And you realised, I'm in trouble now. I'm heading for jail.
Yeah. A big, big prison, 20,000 prisoners in Mashhad Central Prison, all types of prisoners, murderers, drug offences, rapists, paedophiles, the whole lot.
And it's completely different to prison as we know it. I mean, you had to wash your own clothes, for example.
Yeah, have to wash your own clothes. We got prison food, but we were allowed to make our own food. There's a little shop in our block. We could buy vegetables and stuff like that to make meals for ourselves.
And the money that you had to add on your possession when they picked you up, did they give that back to you or access
no.
to it?
No. So the money was sent by Roland, my husband, to the French government, sent to the embassy. And the embassy in Tehran would transfer money to my prison credit card. I had a prison credit card.
It's extraordinary.
All very well organised.
Yeah. Now, in the cell which you occupied, how many people were there?
We were roughly about 15, went up to about 17. The cell had a mixture of political prisoners and some other foreigners who were drug traffickers from Bahrain, Pakistan, Turkey. But most of them were political prisoners.
And what were they facing, or did anybody really know what they were facing?
Well, they all had got sentences. For example, Turkish drug smuggler who's been smuggling for heroin, he got 25 years. But the political prisoners, I'm a very close friend with Taj, who's still in prison. He's been there now for 10 years, political prisoner. He's 43. He was condemned to death, and that was squashed when I was there. And I've been in touch with him through various contacts, and he's been re-condemned to death 2 weeks ago.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Throughout all of this, I mean, there were people who were effectively on death row expecting the death sentence at any stage, other people with long, long sentences. When did you go through a judicial process to determine how long you would serve?
I had a first court case when I was brought to the courts, when you go in full prison uniform, handcuffs, shackles on your feet, handcuffed to other prisoners, you turn up at the law courts, cross the street, people watching you, into the courthouse, up to the judge, and they wanted me to sign papers, which I didn't understand, and I refused. And they brought in a guard to try and persuade me, and I said no. I said, would you sign a paper in Irish or in French? And the judge sort of looked at me and told me to go away. And as I was walking out of that, he said, you will die in prison, through his translator.
Which has given us the title of the book.
And it was about March, April, when I had a first serious court case with television cameras, the whole works. And there I was told, you get 3.5 years in prison, but we're going to ask for an amnesty because of your age and your health. A week later, I went back. And there I was told, no amnesty, no pardon, you're getting 6.5 years.
A desolate feeling, I'm sure, when that was passed down.
Yeah, terrible.
Now, meantime, people are beginning to get very active on your behalf. I mean, you eventually got to see the Irish consulate representative and a lot of activity back and forth. Your family were agitating on your behalf, and your husband, Roland, also agitating on your behalf on the French side of things. What ultimately got things moving?
I think the Irish were key in getting me out. I discovered, when I met Micheál Martin back in the summer last year, and I discovered that the Irish had sent out a delegation when I was arrested, which I didn't know about. And when I met Sonia McGuinness, the Irish ambassador, on the 1st of May in prison, and I said to Sonia...
And she raised a few eyebrows when she came in.
Oh, I could say that again. I mean, she rushed up to me and hugged me. And the guards, because in Iran, a man cannot touch a woman unless she's his sister or mother or wife. Yeah. The guard was open-mouthed when Sonia came up and gave me a big hug. And I told Sonia that day, Sonia, I can't take any more of this. I said, everybody's telling us to keep quiet, don't upset the Iranians. And I said, you have to upset the Iranians, get them worried about us. And I told her, if by the 15th of May nothing has happened, I'm going to make a lot of noise and upset people.
Now, over the course of your incarceration, you went on hunger strike for 10 days?
A bit more, about 17 days.
17 days. And really, it was your dad's concern. Who's what, 9?
He'll be 99 next month.
99 next month.
And everybody was sending messages through, because I didn't get any letters when I was in prison. It was just messages read over the phone, and people were saying to stop the hunger strike, you're doing damage to yourself, etc. And eventually my dad wrote to me and said, please stop. I'd already lost my brother a few years ago. And the idea of losing his second son it was too much for him.
So you stopped. Now, ultimately, you get out and you're flown first class, effectively, out of there. But the impact of your incarceration although you were never really, really abused in the kind of the typical sense, beaten up with whatever, that never happened to you.
No, there were two punch-ups in the cell with other prisoners, which I had ended up getting involved in to try and stop. One was with Taj, who some other prisoner insulted him, and Taj went to jump on the other guy, and I was holding him back to stop them beating themselves up. And another occasion, a prisoner tried to throw a thermos flask at Benjamin, who was on hunger strike. He was at about 100 days. He's quite weak. And I stood between the two of them to try and stop the punch-up. There's a lot of violence in prison. I saw a lot of other prisoners, you know, blood, because I was in the medical centre every day. It's not a very nice place. But it's the mental torture that was the most difficult.
Now, earlier on the programme, I was talking to John Simpson, and he was saying that there's a huge cohort of the population in Iran who are really looking westward. They would love a rapprochement and a reintegration in, if you like, the civility of Western civilization. How true is that?
That's very true. Iranian middle class are extremely well educated. Nobody looks at the local television. They all look at foreign television channels. I was amazed how quick the news of the vigil outside the embassy here in Dublin, that same day, I discovered afterwards, that same day, that information got to prison Mashhad. Everybody knew about it. The prisoners' wives would ring the prisoner when he was talking and say, "I saw your sister on television."
My goodness.
What do you mean, my sister on television? I didn't know that. But the Iranian, I remember once in a restaurant in the provinces, a woman walked up to us in public and she said, "Our government, we don't like them. We're welcome to Iran. We don't like this government." The Iranian population are...
So there is the possibility for fundamental and profound change in Iran.
Oh, there is. But the regime, the hardliners are, you know, making things difficult. And this is the problem.
I suspect you're suffering from PTSD.
Yeah.
It'll take a while to get back.
Yeah, it's tricky.
And your work, you're operating in tourism.
It's very hard
to get back to that.
I've given up. I've stopped. The psychiatrist said you shouldn't go back to work. I see a psychiatrist every week, either physically or on Zoom. Anything can spark it off. I mean, I was in a cinema a week ago at a film. I just had to get up and walk out.
The trigger?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can be anything violent or associations with the Middle East just sets me off and I can start crying, or not less now than at the beginning.
And I suspect that today, the day that's in it, is a bit of a trigger too.
It's a really strange day. Just think this time 2 years ago, the guys walked up to me and a nightmare started.
Well, the book is a fantastic book. We've only touched on the surface of Bernard's time in prison as a hostage of the Iranian state. It's called You Will Die in Prison, subtitled My Time as a State Hostage in Iran. And Bernard Phelan, thank you very much for joining
Thanks,
us on
Matt.
The programme today. Okay. Actually, we've had lots of comments coming in about you, Bernard, people saying... was the activities of other European countries in any way effective in getting you out?
I don't think so. I think it was mainly the Irish and the French. I mean, it was primarily the Irish. Cause
there was some talk of a prisoner exchange.
When I was released, I discovered that there was I knew there was an Iranian prisoner in Belgium. And shortly after Benjamin and I got out, Olivier van der Kassel, a Belgian hostage, was released, and in exchange for the Iranian prisoner in Belgium. And we were part of that package.
Okay. And the other question people want to know is, do we have a kind of a protocol or a program for people like you?
This is the big problem. When you come back back to freedom, there's no proper system for helping us. I'm trying with two other hostages, the Belgian hostage and the Swedish hostage, with the EU to try and structure a response mechanism to help us to rebuild our lives. You come back, you've no passport, no credit card, no phone, nothing. You're just there in your flip-flops. And you have to
and
start
you still
your life
have
again.
Those flip-flops.
I still have those flip-flops.
The prison flip-flops.
Yeah.
You also make the point, just thinking of the flip-flops, that you take them off before you go into the cell, that the whole thing is very clean.
Yeah, the Iranians are fanatical cleaners. They're always cleaning, washing, and they're very, very fussy about that. And they were very, I remember the first time I walked into the cell, when the first day I was there, and I walked in and Benjamin turned around and said, take your flip-flops off and put them on the rack. And then you had different flip-flops to go into the bathroom area.
My goodness, yeah. Very hygienic.
Yeah, very, very hygienic. Mm.
All right, Bernard, once again, thank you very much for joining us. That book again, You Will Die in Prison, So-Called. Now, don't forget, our items are uploaded as podcasts, which you can listen to on the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.